So I want to tell you about the density of states of quantum spin glasses from isotropic entanglement. So the gist of the idea is that there is a very hard quantum problem. Namely, you want to find the density of states of quantum spin glasses. It's proved to be very difficult. And you can approximate it. You can hope to approximate it. You can approximate it using the Dumold classical way, which we all know would not be adequate, because you know otherwise we wouldn't have the richness of condensed matter physics. And there is this other fancy hot new topic called free probability theory that you can use. I'll define all these things. And we tried both ends. None of them were adequate, so we came up with isotropic entanglement. So free probability theory, just to give you a one-sentence summary, it's tailored for treating the probability of non-commuting random variables. Right? So in statistical mechanics, you know that, for example, the velocity of a gas are random numbers, say Gaussian, if you have a Maxwellian distribution. They commute. You can get the density of the sum by convolving the densities of the summands. It's normal classical, what we call classical probability theory. But if you have non-commuting random variables, what would be a very good example of non-commuting random variables? Okay. What would be a perfect example of a non-commuting random variable? How about a random matrix? Right? Random matrices would be excellent host of application for non-commuting random variables. So then, you know, you say, all right, I sum matrices. What would be the distribution of the sums, given the distribution of the summands? These are the type of questions that free probability theory, well, some of them, answers to some extent, all right? So that's what we mean by non-commuting random variables. So, yeah, oh, this is a work done jointly with Alan Edelman. He's an expert in random matrix theory and applied free probability theory. And let's get into it. So let me make a couple of acknowledgments before moving on. I want to thank Peter Shore, my advisor, for everything, really, Jeffrey Goldstone for various many, many good discussions. And I also have had a discussion or two with Xiaogang Guan, Patrick Lee, Peter Young, Mehran Kardar, Aram Harrow, and Salman Beghi. So QMBS on the top stands for quantum many-body systems, okay? Now, in quantum mechanics, we have basically two, in any eigenvalue problem, we have two main parts. You want the eigenvalues and the corresponding eigenvectors, right? That's how you solve an eigenvalue problem. So solving the eigenvalues is what I want to focus on today, though my thesis is really on the states, low-lying states. But this is, if we have time or if you ask questions, maybe we can say some things about the states, the ground states, and so forth. But let's talk about mostly eigenvalues today. So when we talk about the energy distribution, or when I tell you about the eigenvalue distribution, I like to use the term eigenvalue distribution. In the literature, synonymously, you can talk about level densities, density of states, energy spectrum, or just the spectrum. These are the names you hear. So by that, we mean an honest-to-goodness density, not just a list of energies, not just a bunch of numbers that would tell you what kind of energies the system would have, but the true density. So what is the probability associated with a given energy? So a density is a positive function whose integral will be 1. So it'll be a probability of a given eigenvalue. Now, why would you care? Well, a mathematical answer would be that any eigenvalue problem starts with any eigenvalue problem, namely finding the eigenvalues and corresponding eigenvectors, will start with getting the eigenvalues. So mathematically, it doesn't need motivation. Well, for physics, if you have the eigenvalue distribution, you have your Boltzmann weights, right? E to the minus beta E sub alpha over Z, the partition function. And if you have your Boltzmann weights, you have your partition function. If you have your partition function, you have thermodynamics of the system. Density of states give you more than just the partition function. Some transport phenomena, such as the heat conductivity or other transport phenomena like heat conductivity is not really a transport phenomenon. Heat conductivity or other transport phenomena like electron hoppings or, and so forth are also functions of density of states. So they're also interesting. A more general question one wants to ask is, suppose I give you matrices M1 and M2. with known distributions. And I ask for the distribution of M1 plus M2. Right? What would be the distribution of M1 plus M2? A bad linear algebra question would be, you know, just sum the eigenvalues. Right? It's a bad answer because they may not be diagonalizable on the same basis. So the question is impossible to answer without further information about the eigenvectors from the densities alone, right? Because the structure, the entries could be summing and mixing in very complicated ways. And this is why quantum physics is very difficult, or many applications that involve matrices are very difficult. So, you know, you can have in your Schrödinger equation, you can have the Laplacian, which is diagonalizable in the Fourier basis, and you have your potential, which is diagonalizable in the real basis, or real space. And when you put them together, it becomes very difficult very fast, because you run out of computational resources to do exact diagonalization, and you cannot really work in diagonal basis and break it apart. Okay, well, you all know these things. So the goal of this talk is, you give me a geometry of a lattice. You say, all right, I have nearest neighbor interactions on some lattice. My local terms have some known distribution, so the local terms are known. The dimension of the spins, I'm gonna work on spin systems today. The dimension of the spins are something, like D equals 2 would be electrons, or spin half fermions, or D equals 3, you know, spin 1, or what have you. Given the local interactions, give me the spectrum of the whole system. Okay? That's really the goal. So, well, the problem is very difficult. It has, if you look at, actually, very nice thesis by Brandau, Fernando Brandau, and a paper by Brown, Flamy, and Schuch, they showed that this problem to solve exactly is very, very difficult. So on a line, is QMA complete? Just counting the states from a general lattice, is Sharpe complete? So to hope to get the energies and their counts is really hopeless if you want to go via exact routes, okay? So then you want to ask the question of, well, what can you do? Should we just give up? Or can we do a good approximation? Although we are not confined to it, let's focus on a one-dimensional chain. So the model problem is really this, right? You have spins sitting at sites 1, 2, 3 to n. There are local interactions, H1, 2, right? That applies on the state of 1, 2 system. So if this is D, Hilbert space locally is C to the D, right? And so is this. H12 is D squared by D squared matrix, right? That takes the state of the 2 and updates it, and so forth. Algebraically, this is written with this formula, where if the very first term is H12, identity on everybody else, identity of size D to the N minus 2. Second term is one identity on this term, H23, translated with H23, identity D to the N minus 3 on everybody else, and so forth. So each of the summons is D to the N by D to the N matrix. Each one is simple alone, because if you look at a single one of them, this you can just diagonalize by conjugation locally. And rest is just easy. It's just copying, right? You copy on the left, right? You just put those diagonal values, you just copy them these many times. And then you grab every one of those and you expand it. That means you take every element and you make the multiple of this identity, right? So you just get one big identity matrix that has these eigenvalues with the degeneracy given by these sizes. The problem is when you put them together. When you look at the sum, it'll become difficult. By the way, if these local terms are generic, again, by generic, we mean random matrices. So generic matrix is, you know, you put your hand in the bag of all matrices, you grab one. But the chances that it'll be diagonal is not very high. The chances it's gonna be some random matrix. So it's generic, right? Every example you build will be a probability measure 0. So these in physics are known as quantum spin glasses. So you have spin systems with generic interactions, so they're like spin glasses. And since it's quantum mechanics, they're quantum spin glasses. So I wanna give you some intuition about this, right? I'm gonna grab a chain of length 6 with local dimension 4 and show you the non-zero entries of every of the summons and then the sum, All right? The very first element would look like this. Why? Because you have H12 quant or tensored with some identity, some big identity. This means grab every element in here. Suppose H12 is H11, H116, H161, H1616, quant identity. That means put an identity next to every one of these. Identity of very big size, right? So every element here will become one gigantic diagonal, right? Because it's just a constant multiple of identity. So consequently, you get this stripe pattern, right? We all see this, right? Every one of these is like a constant multiple of identity. If you look at every sub-square matrix, some constant multiple of identity. You stack them next to each other. Well, the second one is going to look like identity on the first side, H23, identity on everybody else. This is like putting H23 on the diagonal four times, and then multiplying this identity into it. So getting those stripe patterns. So the second term will look like this, where here, because of resolution, you cannot see all the zeros. So the colors represent non-zero elements. Where is white? It's zero, okay? So this is the SPI function in MATLAB. You put SPI of a matrix, it gives you these patterns. And number of non-zero elements is these many, NZ non-zero. So you know you have 4,096 by 4,096 elements, these many of them are non-zero. So here you have a lot of zeros that you can't see because of, you know, resolution and pixelation. And the next term, of course, this becomes D squared, so there's 16 blocks. Again, they have some zeros in them. And you continue this, right? Next term, and the very last term, where you basically have a gigantic identity and H56. So H56 will sit at the diagonal elements, right? And these are really blocks of 16 by 16, but you see them as a band because of the resolution. So the sum, the H we're after, looks like this, where I've really superimposed all of these together, and you get this pattern. You might have seen such pictures before. These are spin glass pictures. So to get at the problem, let's first see why is the problem difficult. So when you look at a line up here, this is the same equation I showed you before. If you just look at the odd terms alone, the problem is not difficult. Why is it not difficult? Because you'll have something like this where I've skipped an interaction. This means these guys are interacting. These are not. These are interacting. So, you know, H12, H, skip 2, 3, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so forth. K odd. Bundle all those terms, call them K odd. And it'll be easy. Why is it easy? Because I can come in here and locally diagonalize by conjugation. And that will not mess up the basis for the next one. They don't talk to each other. Their subspaces are separable. Okay? So I can locally diagonalize. If I locally diagonalize, then all it amounts to is summing diagonal matrices. Summing diagonal matrices, well, you know, there's a little bit of copying. You have to take care of permutation matrices where things are put when you sum them, but we can work that out. It's not that hard. It's really not that hard to sum diagonal matrices. And also the same, so these are for just H odds. The same story for H evens, which are shown in pink. H evens alone are very easy. The problem is when you put them together, because now if I move to a basis in which these guys are diagonal with no loss of generality, that will necessarily mess up the basis for the pink ones because of the overlap at the site. So I cannot locally do anything. Even if there is a global basis, I don't have a way to get at. So what we call QA are the eigenvectors of the odds alone. So sum all terms with K odd and column H odd. They'll have this structure for their eigenvectors. You see, it has a separable structure. Every Q is a d squared by d squared matrix. And I took the size of the chain to be odd. So I have an identity at the end and an identity at the end for the evens. So H12, H34, but the evens, it starts with an identity because it's H23. But this identity is D by D. Does this make sense? Any questions? So far, so good. So you see, the problem is this is a box of D squared by D squared. This is a box of D squared by D squared. This is a box of D squared by D squared, but this is a D by D. They don't line up. If they lined up, life would be a lot easier, because then you would just multiply this to this and multiply this to this. But they're shifted, just slightly shifted. And that shift is the cause of all the problem. So the subspaces don't line up, so you can locally treat everything and then look at some separable structure globally. Okay? So, well, what can we do? Well, you know, the first step of problem solving, let's write down a crisp problem definition. So we have H odds and H evens. For any symmetric matrix, I can do an eigenvalue decomposition, right? Where A is the matrix of diagonal random matrix of eigenvalues. QA is the eigenvectors of odds. QB is the eigenvectors of evens. And B is a diagonal matrix for the H even, random eigenvalues, right? With no loss of generality, switch basis such that the odds are diagonal. So I can multiply the whole thing from left by QA inverse and from right by QA to get this, right? Where Q sub Q is defined here. Okay? So the spectrum of this is what we want. So I want you to note one thing. The matrix is a D to the N by D to the N matrix, right? However, the number of random parameters going in are given by the number of local terms here, because we have random local terms, right? So for the case of a line, we have really linear in N number of random parameters. Sorry, I have to stop speaking for a second. I'm back. So for a generic matrix, you would have d to the 2n, really, random parameters, if your Hamiltonian was generic. But the quantum problem on a line has linear in n number of random parameters, given by the number of local terms. In the case of an open chain, it's really n minus 1, right? We have n minus 1 summons, right? And each one of them gives you a d squared by d squared maximum random numbers, so it's proportional to n. General lattice, some polynomial in n. So given that, well, we just said that this Q sub Q, let me emphasize, Q sub Q looks like this, where it's given by QB inverse QA. They're shifted with respect to each other. It's an ugly object. Well, I don't know if it's ugly, but it's a difficult object, okay? So because of this, we have all this trouble of exactly solving the problem, so you want to approximate it. Well, how can we approximate it? One way to go is to say, well, just ignore it. Ignore Q sub Q. As if you know, classical world is good enough. That means assume you can find bases in which H odds and H evens would simultaneously be diagonalizable. Right? That amounts to replacing Q sub Q with an identity matrix, where Q sub B and Q sub A are the same. So, you know, inverse of one times the other gives you identity. That would be the classical approximation, right? What that means, so to give you a picture, I talk about the orthogonal group here. Maybe I should expand on it a bit. So Q sub Q now has zero random parameters in it because we replaced it with an identity. So that means every matrix is represented by a point. So maybe a pragmatic way to look at it would be, suppose you grab A, you calculate its eigenvectors. Stack them next to each other. You get a d to the n by d to the n matrix, right? Every eigenvector is d to the n by 1. You put them all next to each other, you get d to the n by d to the n matrix. Look at the orthogonal group in d to the n dimensions. this matrix will pierce the sphere at a given point, right? Given by these directional vectors. Represent that point by the matrix A. The statement here is that the same point can represent B, because you can take the same matrix of eigenvectors for it, okay? This is a known object. You can get the density of the sum by just convolving the density of the summons. This everybody knows. But there's another extreme that is not well known, but is very powerful, and that is when A and B are in generic position with respect to each other. You pick an A, B can be anywhere on the orthogonal group with respect to it. That means the eigenvectors are random beta har with respect to one another. They're in totally non-correlated. They're fully non-correlated. You pick one, the other one can be anywhere on the orthogonal group. So those matrix of eigenvectors are random fully with respect to the A you picked. This end, if the matrices are infinite, is captured by free probability theory. If it's finite, we define the finite version of free probability theory that scales up to free probability theory at infinity. And in practice, infinity is really 30 or 40. I mean, if you have a 30 by 30 or a 40 by 40 matrix, it acts pretty free already. But, you know, rigorous result of mathematics require asymptotics and infinity. So that means the Q here now, it doesn't have the subscript Q, Q sub little q. This is a random har orthogonal matrix. So it's a random matrix. Har, by har, we mean uniform, uniformly distributed, har measure. And it's orthogonal. So at least as far as parameter counting is concerned, you know, zero random parameters in Q, exponential, the quantum problem, just as far as the random parameters are concerned, lies in between, right? What we just talked about, on a line, it's proportional to n, and for a general lattice, is a polynomial in n. So it just suggests that maybe the quantum problem can be expressed as a weighted sum of the two extremes. Maybe the quantum problem can be captured by finding a suitable parameter p that tells you to what extent mixed eigenvalues that would be obtained at this extreme with the eigenvalues obtained at this extreme. Yes?
Quantum problem, do you mean an extended quantum minimal system?
Yes, I mean the exact problem.
Right, but the isotropic case. The isotropic case could also be a quantum problem where you only have one quantum system.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so by quantum, you mean quantum plus locality of interaction?
Yes, I mean quantum many-body.
Quantum many-body.
Quantum many-body system, yes. So if you have, that's right. So if you have just one Hamiltonian, suppose you have infinite dimensional spaces, spins, and you have one Hamiltonian between them, and that Hamiltonian, say, is some A transpose A, a Wisher type matrix, you have the eigenvalues, right? It's just given by random matrix theory directly. Yes, number of local terms.
And the fact that
there's local, yes. Right. So if you had, you know, three local.
I was wondering why you call that quantum.
Oh, I see. That's actually a very good question. So the reason is that by quantum, all along, I mean this problem, where, you know, we really have this tensor product structure
right.
built in.
So that's
exactly. That's exactly what I mean. Nothing more. So we're in the isotropic case, I kind of ignore this tensor product structure and replace this multiplication by just one gigantic har uniform orthogonal matrix. Can that arise? Well, in a non-local interaction, it may, but generally, it's just some random har orthogonal matrix that violates locality. Okay. So, you know, maybe we can find a suitable parameter p, they'll tell us to what extent the quantum problem can be expressed as the two extremes, and maybe it'll work. Maybe not, but maybe it'll work. So before moving on, let me show you a result so you can decide. I see some of you are getting the after lunch effect, so you can decide whether you want to pay attention for the rest of the talk. So here, grab n equals 5, so 5 sites. D equals 2, you have, say, electrons or spin half particles. You know, R is the rank, so you have random matrices. If you care to know, they're Wisher-type matrices. Wisher-type matrices are, it doesn't really matter what the local term is. Wisher type matrices are, suppose A is a, does everybody speak MATLAB? Everybody knows MATLAB here? Who doesn't know MATLAB? Okay, great. So A has entries that are random Gaussian numbers with mean 0 and variance 1. And then A transpose A would be a Wishart matrix. So it's symmetrized by multiplication. If it were A transpose plus A, these are the GOEs, or, you know, Wigner matrices, if you wish, where the symmetrization is done by a sum. You can have negative eigenvalues. The former is positive semi-definite. Anyway, so these distributions are known. So we took the local terms to be Wishart type for now, okay, as an example. And in MATLAB, A would be rand n of d squared. Okay? So here, exact diagonalization is shown in red dots, where I've averaged over 500,000. At the time I was naive, 500 would have been enough to, you know, let those fluctuations die, because every instance of the problem will be a little bit different from the actual distribution because it's some random numbers, right? You want to sum over average so you get a smooth distribution. So if you just take the classical approximation that we talked about, where Q sub Q was replaced by an identity, you get the dashed gray curve. Can you see the dashed gray curve from the back? So you see it's not good enough. It doesn't do well at this tail. It doesn't do well in the bulk. It's kind of like ahead of the actual distribution. Yes?
Sorry, I don't understand the meaning of this part. So what's driven by eigenvalue? The actual value good. Of the eigenvalue?
Yes. Yes.
If I take the sum of Hamiltonians and then I look at
minus
the Hamiltonians?
Minus the Hamiltonian, yeah, they'll flip.
It will flip. I just would expect. I don't understand why this shape is not symmetric. Is that just the low part of the spectrum? These eigenvalues are just the smallest ones?
No, these are. Oh, that's actually a good point. I'm not looking at the ground state distribution. I'm looking at the full spectrum of that.
Right. But what I don't understand is why.
Why isn't it symmetric?
Yeah, with respect to small and large eigenvalues.
Why should it be symmetric? You know, you have 0 at one end and infinity at the other. The support is not really finite necessarily. You would expect some kind of a tail.
So I guess that comes from the type of matrices you're looking at?
Absolutely.
Right.
If you looked at this side, I'm looking at this side. If you looked at this side, you would get something that was symmetric about 0.
Okay, so and probably that's what I expected, but that's the type of matrices you're looking at. Okay.
Exactly. Thanks. So they're kind of pushed away because they're positive semi-definite. But yeah, if you use GOE types, GUEs, you'll get something more symmetric. And I'll show you examples that are pretty weird, like you have plus minus eigenvalues, Bernoulli distributions, and so forth.
Do we have to think that this type of matrices are representative of what you have in many other problems?
That's another very good question. So where do you realize quantum spin glasses? Right? Suppose you have semiconductors. You have to really work it out. I don't know if the Wishart matrix will give you some particular disordered system. But so the short answer is I don't know what Wishart matrices would represent in quantum inequality systems. Maybe it does. I just don't know. But how do you realize quantum spin glasses is something I want to say a sentence about. Quantum spin glasses, generic local interactions. Suppose you have we were just talking a minute ago, and suppose you have a semiconductor, crystalline semiconductor. You'll have a regular lattice distancing. Interactions in nature are functions of distance, right? Spin couplings are functions of distance. So it's not really direct, it's a function of distance. So the spins will couple in some particular way, and it'll be the same for everybody. So it's crystalline, everything is regular. Suppose you introduce magnetic impurities into the system, and these magnetic moments will couple with the magnetic moment of spins and will distort the lattice in some random way. So the interactions will get distorted about some mean, right? So the interactions, now the strength of the interaction in some random manner will get changed. And that randomness is modeled, or is hoped to be modeled by spin, quantum spin glass type of systems, where you look at the dipole-dipole interactions and you take into account the messing up of the distances by magnetic impurities.
Sure, but does this tell us anything about what it's going to be, which are type metasystems?
So that's the thing. I don't know what kind of disorder would give you, would give rise to Wisher type.
But we want to take from some, I mean, this, you're describing a way of reproducing certain density of states for many body systems, which interpolates between the classical approximation and the isotropic approximation.
What do you need? Exactly. So that's a very good question. Yes. So that's the point. We should matrices.
You're talking about this to illustrate.
To illustrate.
Specific, but your result would be more general.
Absolutely. So I will show you results for other types.
Okay. Excellent.
So GOEs, for example, the symmetric ones, are more popular, but they look more boring. So I started with this.
Okay. Good.
And yeah, I mean, the point is, if you have genericity, which I'll define, so it means eigenvectors locally are random, orthogonal, locally. If you have some minor assumptions on the underlying randomness, local randomness, the results apply. It doesn't have to be a Wisher.
Okay.
It's just an illustration. Okay? Okay? All right. So if you look at the isotropic end, which is the other known, you see that it's kind of behind. It also doesn't do well in capturing the red dots, which is what we're after. Okay. It's not doing well at the tails, it's not doing well at the bulk, but you know, when you look at the picture, the quantum problem kind of does seem in between, the red dots. The black curve is isotropic entanglement, which I'm about to describe. This is supposed to be, you know, advertisement, so you don't fall asleep. So when we looked at this curve, we realized that the means were the same for the three cases. For the quantum problem, so the actual exact diagonalization, for the small cases, we can do that. And the isotropic end and the classical end give you the same mean. Also the same variance, which is, you know, the correct statistical encoding of the second moment. But we were not that surprised, right? I mean, any distribution, you know, really, any distribution with the first two moments is some kind of a Gaussian. So you expect the first two moments to match, right? It's not that surprising. But we looked at the third moment, or the correct statistical quantity, which is the skewness. It's a measure of how slanted a distribution is. They also matched. So the first three moments seem to match. That surprised us. So we realized there's something to prove. So we proved the magic three moments theorem, which says exactly that. That the first three moments, the mean, variance, and the skewness of the quantum, classical, and isotropic, the quantum problem and the two approximations, classical and isotropic, are equal. Right? So I have three Hamiltonians, right? I want to look at three Hamiltonians from now on. H iso is A plus Q, B, Q, where this is random, is beta har orthogonal. This is the iso, H quantum, the actual H is A, Q, and H classical, A plus B, okay? So if you look at the first three moments of this, first three moments of this, first three moments of this, they match correspondingly. Okay. So you know, moment we're waiting for is the fourth moment. So if you look at the fourth moment expansion, if you've ever done such expansions, you know, you calculate moments of matrices, 1/ the size of the matrix, expectation of the trace of the matrix to whatever power, whatever moment you want. So the kth moment of a matrix is 1/ size of the matrix, expectation of trace, the matrix to the power k. If you do these expansions, you get the following for the fourth moments. These are really the corresponding terms where you see a to the 4, a to the 4, a to the 4, a third b, but with its corresponding eigenvectors. These here, the eigenvectors are just identity because it's the classical, and so forth. Okay? By a theorem, we call the departure theorem. Well, all this was obtained using trace properties. You know, ABA is like BAB. ABA is AAB, right? You can, trace property has the cyclic property. So you put them all together, you get this. But by a theorem called the departure theorem, you will see that all the expectation values of the corresponding terms will be equal, except from the ones that are both faced and underlined. So in the fourth moment calculation, you already have a lot of terms that are just captured by the classical. And this is where things start departing, therefore the name departure theorem. So the fourth moment is not accessible to us because these terms vary, differ. Please. Yes.
So the,
that's a very good question. Because of this power 2. So this Q, this means AQ transpose BQ times the same thing, AQ transpose BQ. It's the same Q, the elements of Q will collide with each other. You see, before we just had some orthogonal matrix, but orthogonal matrix, you put a matrix in between, you repeat it. If you want to look at an expectation value, then these elements will be very correlated because it's the same matrix. But here, we just had, if you look at these terms, the distinction is that it involves only the Q once. The same Q once. That's the main distinction. So the problem is when you square it, the elements, it's the same elements, and it'll collide with itself in the expectation value. Okay? And, well, you would say, well, it's a tremendous simplification, right? We got rid of all these terms. I can just go look at the classical parts. These are easy. And I'll get the quantum problem. I just have to worry about these guys and how they differ from the actual quantum problem. Not so fast. I mean, when you look at the possibilities, so this is just to tell you that it's scary. I mean, you don't have to really follow the picture. So if you look at the possibilities, what you're looking at really is, can everybody see here? No. Can you see now, I think? So an H odd, or what we represent with A now, is H12, H23 skipped, 3, 4, 5, 6, da, da, da. B is H23, H45, so forth. Now, these terms that I showed you a minute ago correspond to, as we said, this squared. So I have to grab an element from here, then another element from A, and another element from B, smash them with each other. Remember, like, A is the sum of all these terms, right? It's not just one matrix. B is the sum of all these terms. So that term square means exactly this. I mean, take an element from here, take an element from here, then take another element from here, take another element from here, multiply them, look at the expectation of the trace. Okay? Now, why is there so many possibilities? Well, you know, you could take an element from here, repeat your choice. You could not repeat your choice. You could take a neighboring entangling one that has an overlap, repeat that, not repeat that, two repetitions. All sorts of weird things can happen. No repetitions, distance. So yeah, I call it the quantum agony, because at this point, we're like, what do we do, right? So with, you know, enough determination, good cup of coffee, you go through some of these branches. Slowly, you realize a lot of them are valued to be the same. The expectation of trace of a lot of these terms will turn out to be the same. So there's yet another simplification. You see, among all these terms, we said these are the ones that matter. But these themselves are pretty complex because of this tree. It turns out that only these terms matter. Where you take a local term, one element in A, one element in B, and you repeat your choice. So linear algebraically, you're looking at, so H3 represents interaction between 3 and 4th spin. So you have H3, identity on everybody, H4, you repeat the same H3 and H4. And if you look at the indices, I mean, you see that linear algebra is telling you there's entanglement. So though H3 and H4 are IID with respect to each other, the expectation cannot be taken independently. Because at the site of overlap, which is the 4th site, the indices with the subscript 4 are scrambled. You see there's a J4 here, there's a J4 here. Whereas all the indices with subscript 3 are on the left, all the indices with subscript 5 are on the right, the overlapping, the entangling terms show themselves by mixing the indices. That's what entanglement does, right? Mixes indices. The matrices are IID, but the indices are correlated. Okay, so one has to take care and really calculate this by hand. If you really want to get the moments, you have to look at the 4th moment of classical, isotropic, and quantum. Combinatorially, they're heavy, but it's doable. So here's where we assert. We say, all right, now we know the 4th moments, or the correct statistical quantity, kurtosis, which is a measure of how tall and skinny versus how fat and short the distribution is. Those are the only ones that differ. Well, we said, all right, assert as an idea. Maybe it'll work, maybe it'll not. But we asserted that the quantum kurtosis, we match the quantum kurtosis as a convex combination of the classical and the iso. So find the parameter p such that this equation holds. Okay? Remember that p we talked about that told us about the mixture? It comes from the 4th moment, and it comes from saying that, yes, quantum problem is really in between the two. It can be expressed as a convex combination using only 4th moments. Does this make sense to everybody? Yeah, but like the method, what we are trying to do makes sense so far? Okay. Well, I've been telling you about P. So question you can ask is, I mean, can you prove there exists such a P all the time? Right? I mean, can you always form a convex combination? It's just an assertion. Further, in physics, we are usually interested to know what is the thermodynamical limit. When the size of the system goes to infinity, how does P behave? That's the content of the so-called slider theorem. So first here, I solved for P. Because once, a couple of times I got the question, you know, how do you really get P? People were confused. Well, it's an equation with one variable, P. Just solve for it. Okay, just solve for P. So that's the content of the slider theorem. It says, yes, there exists such a P between 0 and 1, that namely the quantum kurtosis is always in between, and that the limit of n infinity of P goes to 1. So the classical approximation becomes very good as far as P is concerned at n infinity limit. Number of particles.
So are you saying that looking at the spectrum by ignoring that the phantom community method?
Yes. At the infinite limit.
Right, but that's what we usually care about.
Yeah. So now back to your question about local terms. Up to here we have been using Wishers as our examples. So I went and I used GOEs, Bernoullis, and so forth. And I kept getting the same P for a given n. You know, keep everything the same, just change the local terms. I got the same P. And I went to Alan and I said, look, I mean, P seems to be universal. You know, it only cares about the eigenvectors. And universality is a word Alan really hates because, you know, everybody talks about universality. But I mean, how can many things be universal at the same time? So anyway, so he said, well, what did you use? I said, Maple. He said, did you clear the memory? I said, well, let me double check. So I double checked. I hadn't cleared the memory, but I cleared the memory. Same result, same P. Then I used Mathematica to make sure, you know, the American way of doing it gives the consistent answer with the Canadian one. Same P. And so we proved the universality corollary. The that says P is independent of the local terms, the eigenvalues of the local terms. It only cares about the structure of, well, maybe that would be a little too much to say, it only cares about eigenvectors, but it's independent of the type of local terms you take. So the formulation, the P, doesn't care about what kind of local terms you take. Okay? And this is regarding your second question. This is a plot of P versus N. This is the isotropic end, P equals 0, classical end, P equals 1. You see that the quantum problem for various Ds, these are the dimensions of the spins. You see that the quantum problem really lies all the way in between. It does saturate to 1, as the slider theorem tells you, but it really does a start for very small systems. Like you said, you have only two terms, right? You expect it to be isotropic. To, you know, mesoscopic systems, if you wish, and it kind of saturates to 1 very slowly. I think, well, since you didn't ask, I'm not going to say. So, because I'm not so sure. I think it saturates as 1 over n. 1 minus 1 over n goes to very slowly to 1, how p saturates. So, and you see that for d infinity versus d equals 2, how the things scale, right? So let me show you some more pictures. This is another Wishart problem, Wishart local terms. N is 11 now, so you expect to be getting bigger p's. P is indeed 0.73, okay? And you have the exact diagonalization, and you have the black curve as the theory predicts. And you see that the gray curve is not doing well, the isotropic end. You cannot see the classical because for the most parts, except from the top of the bulk, if you can see it, it's doing pretty well as P is close to classical. This is my favorite picture. So suppose you have only three particles with dimension 5. So, you know, there are 5 states per site. There's only 3 particles. So you have 2 local terms, H tensor identity plus identity tensor H, right? Sum of H tensor I, so you have H12 tensor identity on the third plus identity on the first.
So that's open boundary conditions?
Huh? Open, yes. And take the local terms to have eigenvalues plus minus 1, Bernoulli's, right? Plus minus 1's. So classically, you expect to get sums of random eigenvalues. So you can have plus 1 plus 1, gives you a plus 2 atom, as you can see, the classical. Minus 1 minus 1 gives you the minus 2 atom. Plus minus 1 minus plus 1, which gives you the 0 atom, right? But quantum, so classically, you can only have Bernoulli distribution, binomial distribution. You're adding plus minus 1s. Okay? So, but quantum mechanics kind of melts these delta functions. You really have, and I'm talking about the red curves now, red dots, you really have a positive probability of having an eigenvalue all along from minus 2 to 2. Further, look at this structure, right? I mean, it's very kinky. It is hard to imagine a fourth moment accurate method would give you cusps, hills, and valleys. And it seems like very high frequency accuracy if you think in terms of Fourier expansions. Okay? And isotropic entanglement captures it very well. The number of local terms are not many, so P is pretty close to 0. That's why you cannot see the P equals 1 curve. It's practically underneath the black curve. Now, once Jeffrey asked me this question, he's very good at finding mistakes, so he asked the question, you know, fourth moment accuracy, this is Jeffrey Goldstone, fourth moment accuracy is by construction, right? Because we match the fourth moments. But does the method predict better than fourth moment accuracy? I mean, is it where it stops? This was to justify that, no, it's better, but I'm going to do a little more. So suppose somebody hands you the first 4 moments and asks for a distribution, right? Well, you know, a distribution should have, you know, sum equal to 1, should be positive, and so forth. But the best things out there in the market are the so-called Gram-Charlier series, which are some ways of building distributions based on moments. You're given moments one by one, and it gives you some series. Here's another one, the beta distribution, that we thought was more appropriate in this case. It's the Pearson.m in MATLAB. It takes the first four, mean, variance, skewness, and kurtosis, and it gives you distribution. So we wanted to compare what you would get from those with the black curve, isotropic entanglement. Okay? So this is what you get for the first picture I showed you. Graham-Charlier gives you this magenta curve or purple-looking curve. Blue is Pearson.m, or the beta distribution. And you see they're not that adequate, right? I mean, they do maybe better than just classical isotropic all alone, but they're not that adequate. And it's even easier to see in the plot I just showed you, this is what you get from a Graham-Charlier series. I mean, as you expect, right? You give it four moments, you should get something smooth and, right? I mean, something with some variance, skewness, and so forth. And this is what the beta distribution would give you. It does kind of well here, but then it just diverges. Like most, you know, Taylor series expansions, you do well to some extent, then you just diverge at the other end with finite moments. And, you know, isotropic entanglement is hinting that it's doing far better than fourth moment accuracy. So why is it better than four-moment accuracy? To really quantify it rigorously, we haven't done so. But I want to maybe get you interested or heuristically argue. At the fifth moment, you'll see the only departing terms will be these guys. Again, that square term that we talked about. These other ones will be captured by the classical. So in every one of the higher moments, tremendous number of terms in the expansion will be captured exactly by the classical and isotropic end, therefore their convex combination. We miss only some terms that are misapproximated because we used P that was from a fourth moment accuracy. So if one bounds the expectation values of these between the classical and the isotropic, you're done. You can show that in higher moments, you essentially capture the moments one by one. I think once I did the combinatorial counting, it's very easy. In high moments, the number of terms you miss, the fraction of terms you miss, go as 1 over n cubed, where n is the size of the system. Please.
So you know those terms can be different. Do you know they actually are different? Right? So
I understand your question. I am sure they're different, but I'm thinking whether I can prove it now. And I would think they're different because there'll be weighted sums. So this term would be different from the classical counterpart because the square would come in here for the classical counterpart, right? And the Qs you would have involving would just be one. So you already have fourth order. So you have homogeneous polynomials of fourth order in Qs, elements of Q, versus second order. So it's a strong indication they should be different, but that's not really a proof. But if you ask me, you know, what would I think, I would say, yeah, I think they'll be different. Now, how different is the question, right? To what extent they're different? Because asymptotically, a fraction of 1 over n cubed of them are missed. But if the moments, the expectation of these, are not far from the convex combination of the, in between classical and isotropic, the two ends, then, you know, all right, so you misapproximate some of them a little bit. What's the big deal? You get the moments very accurately. Oh, OK. All right, well, yeah, we can also do L greater than 2, so not too local. This is a 5-local interaction. Again, the theory does well, OK? Let me summarize very quick. So we have two objects, say odds and evens, pink and blue. Each on their own are very easy, right? You can get your distribution of the sum by a normal or classical convolution, or in the matrix language, just add random eigenvalues. Do it many, many times, histogram them. But the problem is when you put them together, this plus sign is the source of all complexity. Well, we don't know what to do when we put them together. It's the quantum problem, it's difficult. So you can continue ignoring the structure of the tensor product structure of the Qs and just add classically. Just take a normal convolution. Again, add eigenvalues randomly. That'll be the classical end. Or you can use this fancy hot topic called, which has a well-defined convolution, the free convolution, get the other end. That's where the eigenvalues, eigenvectors are in generic position, like we talked about. Or better yet, use isotropic entanglement. That tells you there's a convex, there is a P by matching fourth moments that if you use it as a convex combination of d nu here stands for the measures. If you make a convex combination, it'll very accurately approximate the quantum convolution that we don't have a theoretical handle on. Okay? That is it. We're currently with some quantum chemists looking at the Hubbard model. I have some results on that, but I don't have time. And there's some localization. So, you know, the localization properties, how are they related to the harness of the eigenvectors? Extension to higher dimensions. We're not confined to higher dimensions, but most of the arguments, most of the numerics at least were done, all the numerics were done in one dimension. Explicitly applied to fermionic systems, the Jordan-Wigner transformation, see how non-locality can change things. And the experimental work that we talked about, the semiconductors. Really go after calculating the dipole-dipole interaction, see what kind of local terms it gives you, and match it with the theory, see if it works. But let's just stop here. Thank you. All right.
So when you go to higher dimensions, how does this change? I mean, because you have to shift in many different ways in order to not have overlapping interactions, right?
That is a very good question. So first, you know, we don't have one dimensions are attractive usually when you have Schmidt decomposition, when you think in terms of states. We don't have that limitation. We don't need a left and a right. We just need a decomposition, as you said. So in higher dimensions, you can tile the space in using more than just two decompositions. Sometimes you have to do three. And sometimes, actually, you can extend one-dimensional results into higher dimensions. But you may have more than just two. We just have odds and evens now. You may have other terms. One, two, and three. Then you have to see if it works.
Does the convex combination theorem still hold?
I don't know.
Well, let's thank Ramos again for the great talk.